So, good afternoon. Can you hear me? I hope this thing actually works today. Does it work? Can you? Okay, because my voice is not entirely what it should be like. I've been having some issues. So, also my head is feeling about twice as big and as it should be. I'll see how I get through this. This morning it was quite okay, and tomorrow morning I'm teaching again, so I'm just going to go through this and disappear as quickly as possible. I didn't want to cancel the class because it's a bit of a hassle. I don't like doing that at all. But anyway, I hope I'm making sense. As you can see, there is a slight change in plan. Today it basically said on the list that we were going to do the historical development of English genres. I'm going to tell you a few things about that. That's the first part of the lecture. But then I also had a look at I had a quick chat with Paul Rayson. Remember, Paul Rayson is going to be here in the last week. He is a lecturer from the computing department in Lancaster, and he's a specialist on, corpus linguistics as well. And he is going to talk about spelling variation and in the history of English, and then also in particular how to handle spelling variation when we do linguistics, when we work with historical data, because it's one of the problematic aspects, and many of you who are working on your assignments will in the meantime have found out that if you're looking in the historical corpus like the Helsinki corpus, it is actually quite important to look for all the spelling variants. Wouldn't it be nice if you had a historical corpus where all spelling was normalized on one level, but where the original level was still available on a different level? So, for example, to be displayed to you with all the spelling variants, but you could actually search them with the modern spelling. And he's working on a piece of software, or he's working together with other people who are working on software that does just that, automatic spelling variation detection. And the lecture is going to be on that. And since it's going to be about spelling and about various aspects of the history of English and spelling, I thought I'd give you a brief rundown of the history of spelling. It's really quite brief, don't worry. And I'll add a few things about punctuation as well, in preparation for the lecture in 2 weeks' time. Next week, we're getting more corpusy here. Next week there's going to be... My voice is not loud enough. Can you please chat either outside or listen to me? Thank you. Next week it's going to get more corpusy, as I said. We're going to have a lecture on historical corpus linguistics as a method to investigate the history of English. And I'll tell you what's available there, and also a few methodological issues of dealing with historical data of that sort. Okay. Right, that's the plan for today. Otherwise, I do not have any admin. I've received quite a few assignments already, some longer than I had hoped for. Sorry, some longer than I had hoped for. I get some concerned emails from people. Do I really have to write about 4 words? It's getting too long. And I said, don't worry, you don't have to write about 4 words. Don't get too worked up about this assignment. I'm not saying take it easy and submit crap, but don't go the other way where you're working too hard. Okay. Are there any other issues that you'd like to know? Yes. Yes, it's a good question. To be perfectly honest, I haven't written the exam yet. Yes, the exam will take place obviously on the 27th. You know that. I don't need it. Please sign up for the exam. It's closed now, right? Yeah. Okay. If you haven't signed up for the exam but desperately need to, and you've never done this before, there is usually one option for you to sort of sign up late during your career as a student, but I sort of assume that you've now signed up for it already. All I can tell you at the moment is that there is going to be some level of linguistic analysis in terms of text analysis in there as well. So you're going to be given a text to work with and to analyze some of the features of the history of the English language. And there are going to be some more theoretical questions as well. It's going to have at least those two parts. You are not, obviously, not going to be asked to translate anything. If I give you a Middle English text to work on, then the Middle English text will have plenty, well, will basically be translated for you, or will have so many glosses regarding the words that you don't, that you may not know, or probably will not know, that you don't have to worry. Yeah? So it's more going to be on the putting what you see on paper in the context of what you've heard in the lecture, applying a few concepts that I've mentioned. Yes, does that help a little? I'll try to say something more next week. But I'm actually away from Sunday till Wednesday, so there's no office hour next Wednesday. If you need to meet with me, then we'll have to do this next Thursday or tomorrow afternoon. So, Okay, other questions? Good. Okay, in that case, let's move over to actually a slide which I showed many of you, or some of you at least, before in the introductory lecture, where I introduced the difference between genres and registers. And I just want to revise that again. There will be later on also about 2-3 slides where it's basically a revision from something that you've heard before, but the idea, of course, as always in this lecture, is to put it into a historical context. Yeah, remember that I said back then, if you were at that lecture, that registers and genres are defined differently. However, I also said back then, these definitions that you see here, namely that register is defined by internal features of text, so what kind of grammatical forms group together, for example, or cluster together, what types of words, whether they are formal or informal, etc. I'll give you examples later from historical texts. This is sort of the internal definition that, which people tend to take as signals of registers. And then we've got the external features, the sort of the purpose for which the text is made or created. That's when we're talking about genres. So the function or the relation between the writer and the addressee. So a letter has a particular function, but it can be written in a very formal register when it is the opposite of a personal letter, what is it, an official letter or a business letter or something like that. Or it may be very informal, but in both cases we're talking about the same genre. You could say different subgenres, personal letter versus business letter, but it's basically defined by the external function. Recipe as well is a genre. Sometimes you'll see text type be used as an umbrella term when people want to be sort of very general and don't worry about the fact whether it's internally or externally defined. Now, of course, one of the interesting questions is, in this context here, can you see it? Is it bright enough? Or do you want me to darken the room further? Fine. Okay. By the way, I did upload the last two lectures recently, actually only today. Apologies for the delay. So everything is up online now, including the PDFs from Professor Busse and the audio data, etc. Everything should be there by now. Okay, one of the interesting things in this context is, of course, to see how certain genres or certain registers have developed over time. And here is a graph which one or two of you may have seen before, something that Manfred Gerlach, who's written about the development of text types, has published in various publications. In fact, you find it, and this is basically looking at different, well, text types, genres, one could say, namely law documents, poetry, scholarly texts and spoken data, okay, and to see how the different languages... oh no! Let's see how we get through this one. Okay, how the different genres or are represented, or how the different languages are represented in the different genres. Now, as you can see, Latin, and this is basically what I've said before, Latin is of course very important up until about 1600, okay, it loses importance in the last century, for legal type of texts, where, well, it was the majority form, or the majority language for much of the Old English and the early modern English, Middle English period into the early modern English period. By the way, I think this is actually a mistake. Here, the English dialects should actually have parallel bars or whatever you want to call this. There were some legal documents written in English dialects. English dialects, well, there was nothing but English dialects in Old English. That's why it says English dialects here, of course. Then we have standard English becoming more common very quickly as of, well, the introduction of the printing press, as I said before. And then basically all legal documents nowadays, and already in 1700 or just after 1600, are written in standard English. The picture is somewhat different in some of the other genres. Standard English takes over in similar rates. In scholarly texts, it is a bit slower, and this is nicely shown here, where French and Latin keep on a bit longer. What's this little bit here? What language is that? Greek? I don't know. I don't think so. Yeah, I was wondering about that as well. I think so, it is Old Norse, yeah, because it. The thing is, it is missing here, though. And I mean, depending on where in the English, British Isles we're talking about, there should, of course, be some level of, spoken Old Norse as well. But yeah, I think that's what it is, because, well, it fits from about, 900 something onwards. That's a period of the Danelaw, of course. Okay, and French coming in very quickly at 1066, very dramatically, and then basically dwindling in importance after about 1400. I mentioned before that about after 1400, English regained importance in various areas of everyday life. Okay, now of course things are not as easy as that. In fact, you see a lot of switching between languages, and this is actually something that we could look at in more detail. Many of you will know about code switching today, when people, typically bilinguals, switch from one code to the other for various reasons, largely, as is known today, for reasons of, well, social linguistic reasons, trying to, or expressing their belonging to a particular group of, let's say, third generation or second generation, I don't know, Turkish in Germany, etc. But in fact, things like that happened in writing as well in the Middle English period. And there is a nice example here. The first part I'm not going to read to you because my old French is even worse than my modern French. But it means, "I pray to the Blessed Trinity to grant you a good life with perfect health and of long duration." And then the writer switches to English within the sentence to move over some people have claimed that it is the most important part, the most emotional part of it, and that it expresses the kind of, it's got some kind of discursive strategy that's expressed by this. This is just to show you that it's not quite as easy to just say it was that many percent French and then that in English, etc. It's a very fluid picture, but that's always the case in linguistics. Anyway, okay, I'd like to, having introduced the concept of genre and register, I would like to start with looking at some external influences or external factors or external definitions of text types, therefore looking at different genres. And then later on, after about 15 minutes or so, we'll move over to internal definitions, and we're looking at registers. Some things, of course, I've mentioned before. We've got different genres in Old English that are important, and basically we haven't got much more than that. Religious texts. Entertainment, well, I mean, we have poetry, but we presume that this is largely as it is today for entertainment purposes. Scientific language and legal language, and that's basically the genres that we have. And it's interesting to see how they developed over time. In Middle English, we have some additions, some new genres or some new subgenres being formed of these major genres. For example, we have medical recipes that can be found in Middle English. In fact, medical recipes, I'll come back to medical recipes in a minute or so. Actually, on this slide, if I remember correctly, yes. After the 16th century, of course, we see a continuation of many of these genres. We talked about the development of the English Bible and the kind of impact that's had. In the context of entertainment, of course, we see a great widening of subgenres where we've got different types of prose and drama, Elizabethan drama, etc., etc. Still for the same purpose as such, but it's an extension. In the scientific genre, as I said before, initially was largely influenced, or the majority were in Latin and French, but we've got English quite early on, but then they are typically translations. And in legal texts, that's a bit longer than the others. We've got Latin and French being predominant. But then, and that sort of brings me back to the dictionaries, of course, dictionaries had an impact also on the introduction of English into those contexts. We also have some sort of subgenres developing out of earlier genres. I mentioned the medical recipes. I can't remember when it was the first one is to be found. I have to say I have a blackout at the moment. But of course, what we nowadays have is cookery recipes. Okay, people use this to. This is something that we don't have for Old English, and it develops out of the medical recipe, and you can see a transgression, well, not a transgression, but we can see the same kind of linguistic strategies being used, first for medical recipes, then to cookery recipes, and then that genre takes over, basically. Nowadays we have very few medical recipes. Also, we've got things in this list, which I said is the continuation from earlier on, we've got things not in this list. For example, newspaper, or any kind of news, of course, initially with the printed press. Where does it fit in? Does it fit into information? Does it fit into entertainment? Nowadays, news is very entertaining sometimes. Does it fit into something completely different, propaganda? Well, I'd like to say a few words about, I can't hear anything on this side anymore for the moment. It's not the weather. Oh, it's coming back now. Okay, sorry. Something is wrong with me at the moment, but that was very, very weird. Anyway, I can hear that, yes, right. Okay, let's talk a few words about newspapers. What did a newspaper look like in 1670? I've shown you a picture of an earlier newspaper already earlier on in the lecture, but let's have a quick look at the content. Here is a typical piece of news from around 1670, from the London Gazette, which is one of the earlier examples of newspapers. It's about news that happened in Rome, December 16th. The ninth instance was kept here, the anniversary, Instant was kept here, the anniversary of Clement the X in the chapel of the palace Quirinal, where the Pope was pleased to be present together with the sacred college. The next day was likewise performed a solemn service in St. Peter's Church, where was present the whole college of cardinals. The 11th, the ambassador from the city of Bologna had audience of the Pope, where they made their submission to His Holiness in the name of the said city. Okay, that's exciting news, right? But this is what news looked like back in 1670. Several things are different from today. The first thing is, it's not entirely different, but this is foreign news, right? This is news about things happening abroad, but written in English. There's a reason for this. There was no domestic news. It wasn't allowed. And then the other thing has to do with the structuring of news. This is something that we cannot go into in any great detail today, but notice what we've got here is a very chronological ordering of events. This happened on the 9th, then on the 10th, and then on the 11th, etc., and you can sort of imagine that this is almost like a diary. This is what news was like early on. And it is, as I said, news from abroad, and it is politics, or whatever you want to call it. Let's move over into the next century, 1751, and things had changed quite dramatically. On Monday night, three fellows who committed a horrid act of cruelty on a woman, big with child, in a boat near Barnes, going to Kingston, as mentioned in our paper on Wednesday, were apprehended and at a house near Hungerford, and being carried before a magistrate, were all sent to the gatehouse. And as the poor woman is since dead, it is hoped they will all meet with condign punishment for so unparalleled an act of barbarity. Okay. That's closer to the kind of tabloid news that we have today. This is closer to entertainment, entertaining our sort of curiosity, etc. The news has changed by that time quite dramatically. The structure of the news is still not what we have today, but as I said, I cannot concentrate on that today. Let's look at a few factors that led to this development and see what happens afterwards. We sort of take news for granted. It's something that we see all the time. Many of us don't read a print newspaper anymore, but until recently that was the norm. Before the early 17th century, hardly anyone read news in any printed format. It was disseminated by word of mouth, partly because it was too expensive to print. And then the earliest newspapers come up around 1620. They were not called newspapers back then. The term only appeared later. And interestingly, remember, those were news from abroad. They were translated very often from Dutch and German. So they were printed also, sometimes on the continent, and in fact then sort of smuggled into the country, because there was a very strong censorship about what was going on in the country. It was a question of, news were dangerous. I've mentioned this before. I think news are still dangerous today, but censorship doesn't exist to that extent anymore. Censorship ceased in 1642. That opened the way to change of news since domestic news were allowed. We've then got the Civil War, beginning in 1642, where news were then really, and that's why I had the word propaganda before, used very much as a way of warfare, or as supporting way of warfare. It's interesting to also to see how the language changes there. I just write here often in colloquial style. It's still not a newspaper as we know it today. The first of these was really the Daily Courant in 1702. So it's only about, 310 years ago where we have something like a newspaper, and the newspaper being defined as sort of periodical, as something that periodically appears on a daily basis. Okay. Things that have an impact on changes are usually politics, censorship, but then also money. Okay. Remember, in the context of the development of the American variety of English, a tax had an important impact in the sense that people wanted to not feel well, felt that the link to the original mother country was therefore, well, was under pressure because they were asked to pay more money. Something happened also in the context of newspapers. They imposed, partly to stop newspapers from spreading for various reasons, a tax on paper. Okay. If you're a newspaper printer, then that's not very nice. In fact, the result of this was, and this is why I'm mentioning it, that newspapers became smaller. They became smaller because that meant more paper, less paper needed to be used. And it's also that more was squeezed onto a single page. This is where we've got the current format of sort of columns in newspapers from. It goes back to the imposition of the stamp duty simply as a result of, financial pressures. At the same time, though, the news moved out from London and went into the provinces. By 1776, we had a rather large range of newspapers. 53 newspapers is, if you look at how many newspapers there are today, if you count all the provincial ones, of course, it's nothing, but still, quite a few. And then, of course, we've got advances in technology. If the steam press, the steam press allows you to basically print on for longer, circulation can be bigger. Circulation means more exposure, more potential exposure, and that was the case. The way news were gathered changed. Okay, the telegraph being a massive change from before, since now it didn't take weeks anymore for certain things to arrive. No more stamp duty in 1855. And then I've talked about literacy before. Literacy is related, of course, to the proportion of people who can read. And by about 1880 or 1890, everyone, or almost everyone, was at least a potential newspaper reader. It also meant that the social makeup of people who read the news changed quite dramatically, because earlier on it was basically people who could afford it. By the end of the 19th century, this was no longer the case, and that's typically linked towards the establishment of tabloid, or whatever you want to call it, lower quality newspapers, etc. That also perhaps had an impact on what newspapers looked like. There were no illustrations before. Nowadays, of course, we do have them. That's the development of the popular press. 100 years later, major changes in the way news are spread, of course. I don't need to tell you what I'm talking about here. Development of web-based newspapers. That was a quick rundown on the external factors. And basically, in technology, just to summarize this, cheaper paper, mass production and distribution, and the way news were collected and put into then print, change in readership, and the impact of things like censorship or money having an important aspect on the way the genre, the genre developed. And we can see a direct impact of those sort of sociocultural aspects on the way language is used in one particular genre. As I said, we could talk about other things like internal structure. Nowadays we have a top-down approach where we usually start with a sort of simple, with a single sentence which summarizes the whole news, and then it becomes less and less important throughout. And it's also not chronological, but we don't have time to look into that in any great detail. There are other text types that we could look at. Just want to mention one, advertising. Again, this is something that is, it's partly related, of course, to newspaper texts, because it is found as part of a newspaper text as early as the 1620s. Again, there is a dramatic change in with respect to exposure. There's much more advertising by 1700. People were actually making fun of it. Daniel Defoe, for example, writes about that. Interestingly, at the beginning, it didn't look like advertising at all. It looked like regular text in a newspaper, a news item, or some kind of announcement. Nowadays, of course, that's not the case anymore. Nowadays, we also see, and this would be almost a whole lecture course in itself, the language of advertising. We see what I've just simply termed here sort of increased pragmatic sophistication, the use of language to influence you and to buy certain aspect, certain merchandise because of the way things are, because of the implicatures, for example, that are at work via the linguistic means used. Okay, those were the external factors that I wanted to quickly mention. By the way, when you're compiling a corpus, I'll talk about historical corpus linguistic next time, then these type of changes are actually really quite worrying, because what it means is that you sort of have a general idea of a genre, but if you want to compare the genres across time using corpus methods, then the assumption is that you've got something like corpus continuity. Corpus continuity means that if you compare, let's say, a newspaper from 1950 with a newspaper from 1750, it's the same thing. Well, it's the same thing in some way, but of course in many other ways, as we've just seen, it's not the same thing. Can you therefore draw conclusions about language change on the basis of a comparison across two things which are really apples and oranges? I'll come back to things like that next time. Also, for example, science fiction. Science fiction is a genre that is nowadays around in fiction, but it's something that was introduced about a decade or two earlier in the US rather than in the UK, I've been told. And the people compiling corpora of the 20th century have found it very difficult to match more recent data with older data, simply because the genre didn't exist, the subgenre didn't exist to that yet. So, but as I said, I'll come back to questions like that next time. Okay, this is the second set of slides which you may have seen already, because it was from the introductory lecture. I'll do this very quickly. Just to remind you, I used these examples here, if I remember correctly, to show you the different types of features that can be used in different registers. So I think I'm going mad. Didn't I tell you to do this for your assignment? Sorry. Yes, I did. I really mean it when I say things like that. So don't write too much, please, for example. Okay, I think I'm going mad because I have to mark all of this. If I were to shout at you like that, or send this into an email, then this would be, as is typically said, highly interactive. On informativeness, well, there is information in there, but there is a lot less information in there than in this contrastive example. A depressing spectacle was encountered. An entire class of scholars might have been expected to excel in their chosen fields, but no one took the trouble to carry out the exercises requested. In a way, again, someone is miffed, okay, but it's expressed in a very different way. Lower interactiveness, highly informative. The person who's looked at this was, and this is also something I mentioned in the introductory lecture, Doug Biber, in his famous, very influential book, Variation Across Speech and Writing, where he looked at these factors or clusters of features which sort of bundle together and describe or give a quantitative description of the nature of particular registers by looking at what clusters together. I'm not going through this in detail because I showed this to you before, or to most of you, if you remember. I think I did. So there are features which are particularly interactive. Now, it doesn't mean, and that's an important point, that all these features have to occur in a text in order for the text to belong to this particular register. But it's a tendency for these types of features, and this is not a full list, to co-occur more frequently than in other texts, and that makes one more interactive and the other text less interactive. Okay? Some negative features here. Word length, for example, is one of the indicators for informativeness. It's not the only one, as I said. Prepositional phrases, pre-modifying adjectives, etc. Now, what happens if you take this kind of information and try to use this to see how certain genres or certain, well, registers have changed over time, or rather, whether certain genres which are expressed through their external categories or through external features have in fact undergone some changes that are really register changes because their internal characteristics change. Douglas Biber has also looked at that, and I'll give you a few examples of. And what I'm doing here is basically not good, because now I would really have to show you hundreds and hundreds of those examples. So you just have to believe that these are typical examples. For example, 17th century drama. Hold, hold, do not teach my wife where the men are to be found. I believe she is the worse in for your town documents already. I bid you keep her in ignorance, as I do. Okay, this is something apparently said in one of the dramas. In the historical corpus that Doug Biber used from 1675. Another example here. Alas, they were about oysters before their meal. Besides, they were so rotten they would melt in their mouths. All their bones were turned to gristle. We are kept for the standing dish, etc. I don't need to read the whole thing, but if you look at this kind of text and you had actually memorized the list that I showed you two slides earlier, one could do a quick task of this, this is not the time for it, then you would notice that in the 17th century drama, in these texts, but this is now something that you find over a very large number of those texts, you've got first person pronouns, some second person pronouns as well, you've got contractions, you've got present tense verbs. You do also find some passives, and passives were mentioned as a feature of informational text. Let's compare this to 20th century drama. I've got the law on my side. For once, no one can take my daughter away from me. That's my meal ticket, my love. I make mistakes like walking out. You can't put me in jail for that, etc., etc. Random example, really. Imagine having hundreds of those instances. You would then, over using the quantitative analysis, find that there are even more examples or more features of involved characteristics. Passives are, well, in this case here, absent. They are not entirely absent, of course, from modern drama. I'm not saying that. But they are much less frequent. And therefore we've got a more involved style. I'll show you a graph in a minute, but let's look at a different genre, medical prose. Now, one or two of you will have seen this before. I'm not sure whether you can read this. It should be just about big enough. This is medical prose from the 17th century. Sir, I send you here the figure of the liver of a hydropical person, a patient of a hospital, as it was accurately taken by Mr. Faithorn, okay, which I thought so curious as to be worthy the notice of the Royal Society, etc., etc. Is this medical prose as you would expect it today? Obviously not. In fact, it looks much more like a letter. It is actually published in the Proceedings of the Royal Society, if I remember correctly. So it's almost like a hybrid text between a letter and something different. That was very common at that time. If you compare this to this text, which I'm not even going to start trying to read to you, then you'll see obviously that things have changed. A lot of very, very, very long words, difficult words, borrowed words, etc. What's the comparison? Well, the 17th century text, which really was a bit like a letter, has this intermediate position on the dimension one. There are some first and second person pronouns. I found this person or this patient, etc., and I'm sending this to you, etc. I thought this was interesting. It's a private verb. It's a verb which expresses internal thoughts of the speaker or writer. But then again, we've got lots of nouns in a rather dense fashion, in terms of also pre-modification, etc. While the 20th century text is extremely informational. Now, what Biber et al. Have actually done, Biber and some colleagues, is to plot the development of these sort of registered changes across different genres. So, for example, if you compare medical prose to drama, the two text types or the two registers or genres, whatever you want to call it, over time, then you can see that they develop, that they move away from each other in their level of, whether they're informational or involved. So the gap here widens on this particular dimension. It's a multidimensional approach where up to 7 different of these dimensions are actually looked at, and he can use this then almost in a 3 or multidimensional way to characterize the development of text types or registers, as he calls them, over time. And it's one way of describing this type of change. Okay, I have no slide which says mini break. It's just a huge change of layout, because I have to admit there were a few slides which I used from a previous lecture as well before I added a few things, and therefore I didn't spend an hour changing the layout. I think you can handle a change in layout, right? It's back to this flashy, what is it? It's not pink, it's violet or something like that. I need a 2-minute break. You probably need a 2-minute break as well. Okay, let's continue. As I said, this is basically just to give you some background information that will, I think, or I hope, I don't know exactly what Paul Rayson is going to do yet, give you a bit of background towards some of the differences that he will be talking about. Yes, English letters. I briefly talked about the spelling system in one or two, not in every introductory lecture. This year I didn't do it, but the last 2 years I did do it, but I didn't talk about this in any detail. This obviously is not a set of English letters. This is, and the question is, how does he get from one to the other? We are not going to discuss this in great detail, but there is actually a connection. Before I do this, though, of course, this is a different writing system. We have various types of writing systems in the world. Ours is just one. I don't know how many of you know Chinese. Apologies if you do, because this doesn't make any sense. I just used a couple of Chinese characters. But you know, of course, I think that in Chinese we've got every character expressing a meaning rather than in an alphabet-based writing system as we have it. Then we have other systems which you see in Arabic and Hebrew, where we've got consonant-based writings. There's a bit of light fare in what I'm going to show you as well, with a few things that are, I hope, reasonably funny, or a little bit at least, to brighten things up. This is how it would look like in Hebrew. Do you get what it is? Quite obviously, yes. Baba black sheep, have you any wool? Yeah, okay. Baba black sheep, have you any wool? Yes sir, 3 bags full. One for the master, one for the dame, and one for the little boy who... Who what down the lane? Lives down the lane. Thank you. Yeah, you see, it's not that easy. Yeah, if you need a little bit more, and I didn't do this on purpose. You need a little bit. It's an important aspect of our understanding. The vowels, but it is possible. Obviously, it wouldn't be. Otherwise, we wouldn't have Arabic and Hebrew. But anyway. But let's go back to English. It's an alphabet-based writing system, as I said, with both vowels and consonants, obviously. And about half of the world population have this kind of writing system. There are some other writing systems, if you want to read up on them, then places like, I don't know, Crystal's Encyclopedia of Language and others. There's also a book by Cook, 2004, will be coming in quite handy. Okay, let's get back to the Egyptian hieroglyphs. About 2000 before Christ, they seem to, and this is where there's a question mark, there's some disagreement about that, they seem to be the ancestors of our alphabet, at least to some extent. It was not a fully alphabetical system, it had some features of an alphabetical system, but of course many other aspects that are not very similar to the Chinese writing system, in fact, in some ways, but again, not exactly the same. But it seems to be the precursor of some elements in the Semitic alphabet. Around 1750 before Christ. Then we've got the Phoenician alphabet. That's sort of the area around where we nowadays would have modern Lebanon. So it's moving up slightly north, I guess. 1000 to about 800 before Christ. The Greek alphabet developed out of that. And then it moved west. On what is today Italy, the Etruscan alphabet, and turned into the Roman alphabet, which is the basis for what we have today in many ways, as you will remember, I think, from the first lecture. So there is a connection. It's got a very, very long history. This is also exemplifying this again, where we actually go from the Egyptian hieroglyphs straight through to today's letter. Although, I mean, this one I think is not debated, but the others are maybe not 100% certain. Okay, so that's all I'm going to say about the prehistory, basically, or the sort of pre-English history. First English alphabet in Britain was not, well, the first alphabet on the British Isles, obviously, was different from what I'm going to show you, because the Romans were there, so obviously they used Latin there. But the first sort of English alphabet, or the first way to write English, was a runic alphabet, okay, probably related to the Etruscan alphabet. And this is what you find, which is not very visible here, on the Rothwell Cross, which is somewhere not too far away from Lancaster, where I used to live in the north of England. It's in the south of Scotland, and it looks like this. It's amazing. I mean, this cross is actually one of the earliest, has one of the earliest examples of Old English. In inscriptions here, you can't really see this, but this is what the alphabet looks like. It's one of the first texts that we have of Old English. And the church is just open, and you can just walk in, and you could probably add some of your own inscriptions, etc. No one's going to stop you. No CCTV or anything. And it's really, in a way, one of the greatest, not the greatest, but one very, very important cultural heritage of the English language, because it is, well, we don't have all that much. So the fact that Christ was on the cross is what you can see here. And if you know what it means, then you can sort of see the connection. And also you can see how the Etruscan alphabet, if it is from the Etruscan alphabet, which is one of the precursors via Latin, is related to this. Then we're going back to the fact that, and that's something that I've repeatedly said, we've had Christian missionaries who brought over writing through religious writing, as I said in the lecture about the Bible, spreading the literacy, spreading literacy among people. And they used the Latin alphabet, forms of the 23-letter Latin alphabet. And that's something that I already mentioned in one of the first lectures, that there were some missing sounds, or rather, no, sorry, some missing graphemes, some missing letters to express all the sounds, and that's where some of the runic symbols were taken over. So we've got the wind, for example, or the thorn, which is later then lost and replaced by the digraph TH. Okay. My English students used to know this much more, I think, than you might, but let's test. What is this here? Or ye olde minstrels. Should it be the or ye? The, right? No? Ye old cleaning. Ye old web. I'm not quite sure what the old web is, but anyway. It seems to be something that people want used to express they want to have certain connotations about old and homely, etc. Homely in the British sense, not in the American sense. I'll let you think about whether it's the or your, because ye could of course also mean your nowadays. Later developments, I mentioned this before, Q and Z were not used much before the Roman conquest. If you look at the words that are most frequent in the BNC with containing Z, then you can see that they're all French borrowings. Okay. Where does it all lead, or what are we experiencing today? Well, the at sign has, in a way, become part of the alphabet. Not quite, but people are playing with it, and there are different projections as to what might an alphabet look like in the future. And of course, we've also got things like smileys, etc., being introduced into the writing system, so to speak. It also makes it into, or certain of these aspects also make it into advertising. This is for an insurance, right? because change happens. What does this? Can someone explain that? I mean, online you see quite a few uses of words ending in z. Okay. I have a blackout again. Give me a few. The only one that comes to my mind now is wares. What's wares? I'm not sure that was referred to here. It's sort of illegal software, and it's spelled with an s with an z at the end. So people are referring to modern aspects of the internet and sort of being modern by using spelling conventions creatively to sort of create connotations that are positive. Right, that was a few words about spelling. As I said, really only very basic. And I'd like to say a few things, because it's related to this, about punctuation. What's the purpose of punctuation? I mean, are you fighting with punctuation in English? The Brits are fighting with punctuation, clearly. More so than the Germans, I think. What is it? Does it communicate meaning? Now, I'm not sure whether I've used these slides before in one of the very early introductory lectures when I moved to Trier. Has anyone seen this before? Because I checked, but I couldn't find it anymore, so I assume I haven't. What do we use punctuation for? Well, dear Jack, I want a man. Who knows what love is all about? You are generous, kind, thoughtful. Kind, comma, thoughtful. People who are not like you admit to being useless and inferior. You have ruined me for other men. I yearn for you. I have no feelings whatsoever when we're apart. I can be forever happy. Will you let me be yours, Jill? What's this got to do with punctuation and communicating meaning? Well, this is one of those semi-funny things where when you change the punctuation, then the meaning changes quite dramatically. Let's do this. Dear Jack, I want a man who knows what love is. All about you, so all around you, are generous, kind, thoughtful people who are not like you. Admit to being useless and inferior. You have ruined me. For other men, I yearn. For you, I have no feelings whatsoever. When we're apart, I can be forever happy. Will you let me be yours, Jill? Okay, now obviously this is a contrived example, supposed to be funny, and there are a few others, okay? But it makes a point, of course, that using punctuation structures meaning, or is important to communicate meaning. And obviously, in the context of this lecture, I would like to have a quick look at the history of punctuation, and then I think I'm going to let you go rather much earlier than I used to do, but I need the bed. Okay. in ancient Greek, it looked like this. It's a bit like Baba Black Sheep, but different. So many Greek and Latin texts were written without punctuation marks and without spaces between words. This continued with some variation in English until the late Middle English period. No problem reading this. And there are various things circulating on the internet showing that even you can even make sense of things in a much more reduced way. No problem for people who expect this kind of non-punctuated and, in fact, non-white-spaced use of the language. Why was it like that? Well, it saved space, and it was just a convention. Back in 1481, moving forward a lot in time, around the introduction of the printing press, this is something that you would have found. The modern version is here. So the cat said Sir Brune and Sir Isegrim, or Isegrim, I don't know. How be ye the slow? Here is ye, you, right? It is almost even. Here are many bushes and hedges. If he escaped from us and we're delivered out of his peril, etc., etc. With modern punctuation, But in the earlier version, most of the punctuation is different. Okay, we've got some full stops, but then we've just got these slashes which indicate what? Well, some kind of perhaps prosodic or intonational boundaries. And that leads me to asking the question what the purpose of written language is. And if you think back to what I said about, for example, the use of the Bible, but also about levels of literacy, etc., then you will remember that for most people, written language was nothing to be read, but it was something to be listened to when it was read aloud. Although the Bible wasn't even read aloud at some stage, but still. So what people needed was some support in the way the language was structured on the paper to help them read. This is one reason why written language might exist. So, as a script for presenting or representing speech at some future date. Or it could be something, and this is something that many of you will experience today when you read interesting linguistics books or things like that. I suppose you don't read them to each other, although you could. It's a durable record that isn't intended to be spoken. Now, these are two wildly different or very, very different purposes. And these purposes are reflected in the way punctuation works. And what people usually call this is a difference between rhetorical and grammatical, a traditional use of punctuation for this. Just to give you an example, the shadowy figure who lurked outside my office for weeks on end turned out to be a private detective. We've got a comma here. Is this a comma that corresponds to the rules of comma placement, however vague they may be in comparison to German and English? Is this rhetorical or is this grammatical? Well, if I read it again, the shadowy figure who lurked outside my office for weeks on end turned out to be a private detective. I can read it like that. It doesn't necessarily have to be like that, but it supports that kind of reading. If the comma is there, I'm more likely to make some kind of pause or to change, to have some kind of prosodic change in what I do. So, in rhetorical punctuation, a comma is inserted at the end of a major breath group or whatever you want to call it. Intonation contour, intonation unit, there are different ways of referring to this. But this, in fact, is not compatible with grammatical punctuation. Grammatical punctuation, as it is used mostly today, says that the subject and the verb of the sentence must not be separated. They can be separated with parenthetical intrusions sometimes. But even there, the basic rule is that the subject and the verb of the sentence shouldn't be separated. And this is, of course, the case here. We've got the subject in red. Remember, this gives me a moment to say the subject is the whole thing, not just the shadowy figure, or not even the figure, because we've got a relative clause following it, so the whole thing is one noun phrase, functioning as subject, comma, separation, and then we've got the verb phrase. So, really what we would expect is this in present-day English, because that would correspond to the rules of grammatical punctuation. In the Old and in the Middle English period, as I mentioned before, about 15 times by now, the literacy rate was much smaller, so things had to be read aloud. And also, some people actually believe that punctuation one of the driving forces behind the invention of punctuation was actually the fact that they wanted to avoid the kind of impact that the Jill case of, do I like my man or do I not like my man might actually occur. Because as you can see, depending on how you punctuate, you get wildly differing interpretations. And if this happens with the religious text, then you're in deep trouble. So punctuation seems to have been partly introduced as a result of trying to help people who needed to read aloud to make sure that the proper meaning was transferred to the listeners. That's why in the Old and Middle English period, whatever you find there in the context of punctuation is typically rhetorical punctuation. Then, as also you've heard about 15 times by now, we had the invention of the printing press, with all its follow-up features of development, increased literacy rate, larger circulation, etc., etc., and of course, an increase in silent reading. A lot more people, obviously, could afford or could manage or could just simply, could read in silence. And as a result of that, the kind of punctuation that was earlier needed to make sense was no longer necessary because it didn't have to be read aloud. Of course, it also helped that standardization set in where certain things were repeatedly and then increasingly also where one particular style of punctuation was deemed to be part of a standard way of doing things with all the prescriptive and proscriptive weight involved in this. What do we find today? Well, we still have standard English, we still have grammatical punctuation in many ways, although in English punctuation rules are much more varied or much more loose than what we have in German. And people have recently looked at the influence of the internet, in particular email, where for various reasons we see, and this is something that you could also test with a Duck Biber approach of registers, it's much more involved, much more informal, much more colloquial, and it also shows in the way of punctuation, because of the way punctuation is used, because it basically returns to a more oral style, less formal, but also more produced as if it was read aloud. So what we actually see is a shift back, for very different reasons, but a shift back towards what we had in Old and Middle English. The future? I don't know. See you next week.